You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 30th of August 2019. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live at RadioAryan.com tonight, because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victors of World War II, producer extraordinaire, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, how are you, sir?
Well, I'm okay, I guess. And this week's been a, kind of an 8 out of 10, considering it's not too bad.
Have you been working anymore on the final episode of Freemasonic?
Worked on all the credits. I think I mentioned last week I'm going to do a part on conclusions, what the parts have brought us to conclude, which is probably going to shame every academia historian in the business, although I don't claim to be one myself.
Good stuff. Are you going to have any film footage in it?
I wasn't going to do, but one or two things cropped up, which I may use, yeah. But it's just the fact that, I mean, I get criticised a lot on the internet saying, well, Dennis Wise is not an historian, which I never claim to be, but I am a damn good researcher. And these historians who claim to be historians should be ashamed of themselves. They really should. Because if I can find them, I'm bleeding sure they can.
Yeah, you need to, you know, get the sources out there. It's like, you know, there's this constant narrative that they push of either the Nazis being bad or even the Nazis running the EU. But the truth is out there. I mean, this is what I've had this week, Dennis. You know, someone obviously quite intelligent, but they seem to think that the EU is run by Nazis, and they're showing me this information, and I'm saying, but National Socialism was the opposite of what Kudinov Kologi wanted. He wanted to blend all the Europeans with Africans and have them like Egyptian Arabs being ruled over by Jews. And that's the opposite of National Socialism. But then, you know, then this other person is saying, yes, but look at the people that started the EU. Some of them were involved with the Nazis, and, you know, some of them were, but on the outskirts.
Churchill were involved with the Nazis, and he was one of the first ones.
Yeah, well, the people that are on the outskirts, and then there's a banker, Walter Funk, and of course he's a banker. So, of course, he's not going to be treated like the rest of them. And he actually fits in with the first person that we're going to be talking about tonight, because he was in Spandau Prison as well for a while. And even while he was in Spandau Prison, alongside Rudolf Hess, even while he was in there, he was being given cognac and alcohol, and he was obviously favoured for some reason. And he went on to have something to do with the EU. So maybe one episode in the future we can debunk some of these EU links to the Nazis, the big bad Nazis. But tonight we're going to carry on with our little known quotes from the accused at Nuremberg that we began last week. And as I just mentioned then, the first person who we've got some quotes from is Rudolf Hess, who was imprisoned, life imprisonment, and he spent his whole life in prison. Died, I think, at 96. Apparently,
solitary confinement as well.
Yeah. I was just going to say, there was actually nobody else there at the prison from 1966 to 1987. 20 years.
Well, it means a torture, that.
Well,
that's
yeah,
a lot of years.
I think Tommy Robinson, 3 weeks, was it, he did, or 3 months, and he's got post-traumatic stress syndrome from it. And you think, well, this was 20 years. 20 years Rudolf Hess was there on his own without seeing another human being. I read two conflicting reports. One said that the Soviet authorities would not allow him to have any prisoners. And another report I read said that he himself, because of his dignity, he didn't want to see any visitors. But then when he got ill, apparently his family came in to see him at one time. So I don't know whether it was Adolf Rudolf Hess's own choice that he didn't see visitors, or whether it was because the Soviets banned him. But either way, cruel punishment.
I heard it with the British, who really didn't want anybody to see him. and blamed it on Soviets because he knew information they didn't want him to get out.
Well, it certainly seems that way, that there was something that he knew, because the others that were in there alongside him with life imprisonment, they were released. They were released apparently because of ill health, and yet one of them went on to become involved with the EU.
Really?
So why was he kept in there? Because he was in bad health when he was at the Nuremberg trials. He was in a bad way, a terrible way. He was saying that he'd been really mistreated. They'd given him all these truth serum drugs. He was losing his marbles. So before he was even put into Nuremberg prison, he was in bad health. And yet these other ones that were put in there alongside him, they were released because of that.
Yeah. Well, no doubt Churchill had something to do with it. I don't doubt.
Yeah, definitely. But Rudolf Hess, I mean, the guy was a real hero. And people today just you know, people that's pacifist types and types that are against the war, I mean, he should be their number one hero, risking his life to try and end the war in the way that he did.
That's right. I mean, I think he is to a lot of people. I mean, I heard an interview of my son who, that was quite interesting because they dug his grave up again, I think, and they didn't allow it to be a place where some neo-Nazis, inverted commas, could visit. So, he suffered, you know, and his family suffered, to be honest. And he didn't really do anything because all the claims of the Holocaust, he wasn't around anyway.
Yeah, he got in his plane, apparently, you know, against orders. I mean, and this is exactly sort of what the crux of the Nuremberg trials issue was, wasn't it? It was like you shouldn't have obeyed orders. You should have gone against your orders and you should have not fought the war, and you should have stopped. And he did. He went against orders. He got in a plane. He flew to Scotland in the hopes of
never flown before,
averting the war.
Sorry, never jumped out of a plane before.
Yeah,
first time ever.
Crash landed from his parachute. But he was doing exactly what, you know, they were suggesting at the Nuremberg trials that everybody should have done. They were saying, well, you shouldn't have obeyed orders. Doesn't matter that you were given orders, you should have disobeyed them. And that's what the trial was about. And that's what he did. And yet he was still given life imprisonment, crimes against peace and everything else, when all those accusations, as you say, of what happened in the Holocaust, he couldn't have been anything to do with it because he was locked up in Britain.
That's right. And any soldier in the Allied armies, if they don't do as they're told, it's for it.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of an army is it's only as good as it is disciplined. If it has bad discipline and you don't obey the officers, then, you know, it's going to be a useless army.
Well, especially in World War One, when, you know, some wouldn't go over the wall and they were shot. So, you know.
He took a huge risk doing what he did, and he was given no thanks for it. Apparently there was a memorial made for him where he landed in Scotland, a private memorial that was
don't tell me
set
that's
up.
Now.
Yeah, well, apparently the ITV went there with a camera crew and some anti-fascists, and they filmed it while the anti-fascists desecrated the war memorial and smashed it to pieces. And they thought that this was a very clever thing, and it was put on primetime ITV. And the people that smashed up the memorial were sort of lauded as heroes for desecrating a war memorial.
Yeah, someone trying to save the war.
someone who wanted to prevent the war, who just wanted to see peace between England and Germany. And the actual prison itself, Spandau Prison, they demolished that and they ground that down into dust, and then they got rid of all the dust so that you couldn't even get any of the dust saved because they were so terrified that it was going to become a neo-Nazi shrine, as they put it. I think they've got a supermarket there now they put on it.
No doubt.
Twisted. Anyway, as I say, we've got some quotes from Rudolf Hess here. He said, "Just wait 20 years. Germany will have risen again." And I think that's the sort of feeling that they all seem to have.
Yeah, Göring said the same last week, didn't he? I don't think he understood the mind control, what they've been obviously working on even before the war.
Well, they had no idea that it was that the German people were going to be told that the National Socialists had gassed 6 million Jews. They had no idea of that. They can't have done, or they wouldn't have been saying, just wait, once the German people find out the way we've been treated, or once they find out what's happening, or just like what Rudolf Hess is saying here, just wait 20 years and Germany will rise again. They can't have had any idea of the accusations that were going to be leveled against them.
No, the filming and the Hollywood and everything else just to ram it on, especially to the Germans.
He also said, whatever the verdict of this court, I shall be held innocent before the judgment seat of Christ.
That's a surprise.
That's an important one, I think, because when I was reading just then about how he was when he was in Spandau prison, they said that he never attended chapel. He never attended chapel.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. I've heard stories that he was in the cult as well, but obviously it's... It is what it is.
Yeah, they're trying to put him make out that he was anti-Christian in the Wikipedia article, and yet here it's obvious that he's not anti-Christian. He's anti-clericalism. He's anti the church, the establishment church, which so many of them were.
They all were, yeah.
And he says, I should do it all again, even if it meant going to the martyrs' stake to be burned. A temporary defeat in war is nothing in terms of history. Nothing can prevent the Germanic race from fulfilling its destiny. When America and Russia have exhausted themselves in war, then will be the time for Germany to rise from the ashes. So there's a prophecy there that America and Russia were going to go to war. And of course, they had the Cold War. And he knew
they still do, yeah.
So something was going to have to be done about the Soviets.
Yeah.
You know, he knew all the things that were going on, the way that the Bolsheviks were treating the East Europeans. Obviously, Germany and the Waffen-SS had to go into Russia, and these allies saying, "Oh, we're all on Russia's side." He knew that was going to have to change.
Well, they all moved to America, didn't they? In Britain as well.
And you've also
swap countries.
And you've also got the bit where he says nothing can prevent the Germanic race from fulfilling its destiny. Well, that's perfectly true. So what they're doing is diluting the race, miscegenating the race, so that it's no longer there, so it can't fulfill its destiny because it's no longer German.
It's not only the German race, though. It's the countries that won World War II as well. America, Britain, France.
Well, yeah, all of the white race. But he can't have had any idea that that's what they would do. Is
no one can think of such evil.
Race mix them.
You know.
Well, it is beyond evil, isn't it? That to think about doing that to creation, blending it so that it is no longer God's creation. It's a monstrosity created by man. Yeah. It's not an evil that man could think of. Because it's intergenerational, isn't it? It doesn't just last for one generation. It's not like pedophilia. It's a child that's been abused, and that child's life will be ruined, but that's just one life. Miscegenation lasts forever. The effects of that last for the next generation and the next generation and the next generation. 6 generations later, they'll still be trying to get themselves back to being white again, and in doing so, contaminating another generation full of people that wished that they were German.
Yeah, well, I always remember Sarkozy giving a speech saying that, the race mixing, what's going on at the moment, is not enough. And if it doesn't increase, then it will bring in laws that make sure it will do. Which is just incredible. It's an incredible thing to say. You know, I mean, obviously wasn't criticised for it.
And he's Jewish himself, isn't he?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, French Jew.
He wouldn't like to see the Jews being blended out like that, but it's
no chance.
Fine to say that about the French.
Yeah,
Well, that's all the quotes that we have from Rudolf Hess. And he didn't really say that much in Nuremberg because, he was saying that he'd had this truth serum, he'd been drugged up, and he didn't really have a lot of testimony.
And you could believe it, you know. They did some weird things to him.
David Irving, I think he wrote a big book, maybe two books, on Rudolf Hess. I haven't read them, but anybody interested in it, that's where you should go. That's where you'll get the
information.
The most information. I mean, I think he believed that the final suiciding was carried out by MI6 and by the black nurse that he had. I think that's
That's foundation. Why I seem to recall this. It was Britain who was using the Soviets as an excuse. Because obviously Churchill wanted him locked up as soon as possible when he landed, put him in the Tower of London. So he was kept well away from the press all this time. So when he finally was released, or about to be released, he goes and commits suicide. So
yeah, that was it. You're just about to be released, and then this happens. Not very believable. And again, it was apparently much like Epstein, who apparently managed to strangle himself with toilet roll from falling off a bunk bed or something. Mm-hmm. With Hess, there was a radiator in the room, which is obviously going to be 2 or 3 feet high. And apparently he was sat down and somehow managed to lean forward and hang himself from a 3 foot high radiator. So it's just impossible, beyond belief, that we're expected to believe that.
The guy's pretty weak anyway to be doing stuff like that.
Yeah, he's in his 90s.
Yeah.
Well, he might have been 96, something like that. Shocking. Well, next one that we've got there has got a similar name. Sometimes, you know, you can get mixed up between the two. Colonel Hirsch, who was the commandant of Auschwitz, who was executed. And he's the one that they tortured and got him to write these confessions to things that he hadn't actually done. And in the confessions, he talks about prison camps that don't exist. The words that sound like German words, but they're not actual German words, camps or towns, which was a way of saying all of this is a lie. Basically, what he was saying is lies that he was told that he had to confess to. And I think
he threatened to send his wife and his sons, I think, to the Soviet Union. You know, which and there's a clip of him. It shows him in the Greatest Story Never Told, and there's some kind of British sergeant, I think, having a word with him, looking down to him, and he's just a broken man, got both hands clenched, as if, you know, in prayer, but he's just a broken man.
I think there's also something about them reading the confessions back to them in English, or getting them to sign these English translations when they didn't even speak English. All sorts of things went on. I lent out my book on the Nuremberg trials that covered all of that somewhere along the way.
You never get it back.
Yeah, well, you hope that when you do things like that it just wakes up more people and it gets handed on to somewhere else. But it's nice to know that you've got the accurate information there with all the sources. But I'm sure there's a bit where the confessions were signed or read out to them in English, and they didn't even speak English.
I don't think it helped when the testicles were kicked into non-existence, which is what happened to a lot of them.
Yeah, do you know what the exact number of that was? Was it 250 of them had their testicles smashed beyond repair? Or
I don't know the exact number, but I know it was pretty common.
Well, 200 out of 250. And there's the torturer, the British guy that actually did it, he wrote a book about it. You know, sort of bragging about it. The thing is, when you tell people that the people that you've got in your charge are responsible for hideous crimes against humanity, then it becomes all the more easier to convince them to carry out some form of punishment of their own, and that it's okay to torture them because they're not human. They killed 6 million Jews.
Yeah. That's the crux of it.
Well, the quote that we've got from him, he said, "For me, as an old fanatical National Socialist, I took it all as fact, just as a Catholic believes in his church dogma. It was just truth without question. I had no doubt about that. I was absolutely convinced that the Jews were at the opposite pole from the German people, and sooner or later there would have to be a clash between National Socialism and World Jewry." And that's a fact. That's just,
it is a fact.
That's just the truth.
Can I just say one of the articles that I found this week, which I may include in the closing bit of the series, was a Jewish woman talking about the rapes of the Russian soldiers when they liberated Auschwitz. Which shouldn't really come to a surprise to people like me and you and other people who know what exactly went on, but that has never been let out publicly.
Well, there was so much rape that went on at the end of the war, wasn't there?
Yeah, but in Auschwitz, you know, that's never been mentioned.
So that was the liberators at Auschwitz?
Inverted commas.
But I thought when they got to Auschwitz, everybody was gassed and starving and...
Yes.
Not all of them,
this
obviously.
This is a Jewish woman, you know. She actually was saved by her mother. Other girls were screaming around her.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. That doesn't surprise me. Well, he says here that sooner or later there would be a clash between National Socialism and World Jewry. I mean, that had started before Hitler even came to power, didn't it? The Jews were, you know, getting all of the world's press to be against Germany and to be against Hitler, and they started their boycott in 1936, the economic boycott, and we're pressuring other countries to do something about this problem. The same as they act today about people criticizing them on the internet, you know, pressuring these
exactly
companies to do something about them. And it's worldwide. It's wherever people are criticizing the Jews, the YouTube and Facebook and Google, they'll be told they have to shut it down, you know, mainly in Germany. As you know, that's where most.
Yeah, I'm not convinced it has to be told, to be honest, because YouTube is run by Google, and Google is run by two Ashkenazi Jews anyway, so I don't think they need much persuading. And then we've got Facebook, when Zuckerberg's a Jew as well, so.
They probably don't need much persuading, but there was a time when all the information was up there, when your documentary was up there, and they had to have. Her committee meetings, didn't they? The House Select Committee meeting, and they got the guy from YouTube there, and all the Labour politicians were there, and they were demanding he account for himself, and what was Tommy Robinson still doing on there? Why was YouTube recommending Red Ice videos to one of these MPs after she'd been watching Red Ice videos on YouTube, obviously? And it was the same in America. Yeah. You know, they had their recent investigation of white nationalism, didn't they, in front of Congress, demanding that something be done about it. And you can imagine that the same thing happening back then. And you had, is it that Walter Untermyer that was giving that speech?
Oh, right, Samuel,
Yeah, and he was giving that speech. And you know, it was obvious it was on the radio. And he was saying, what are you doing still sending money to these people in Germany? And that was in America. So they will interfere wherever there's criticism of Jews. They'll try and build like a coalition together from within all these other countries, and then direct it at the one country that's dared to think for itself. So I don't know what's wrong with what Colonel Hurst said here, because that is exactly what happened. I'd like to find out more.
Well, they're always going to get the pound of blood, aren't they?
I'd like to find out more about what he said there. You're distorting a little bit there, Dennis. I know we tried to get these settings right before you came on.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's Skype doing these automatic things or what. Bill Gates has messed up all my settings today. I've spent all afternoon trying to fix them. I expect listeners are aware of it already with the latest Windows 10 update. Took away all the sound settings, all the sound system settings, messed around with all the file saving systems, the lot. I don't know why they do it. It's a nightmare. But anyway, we'll bear with it. I guess if you just maybe try not to get too close to the mic or try not to speak too loudly, Dennis.
Sure.
But even that might not work because it's Skype automatically adjusting it. And it automatically adjusts it so it distorts. There we go. Right, the next one we've got here, Wilhelm Frick. And he was the Reich Minister of the Interior. And he remained in the cabinet as a minister without portfolio until Hitler's death in 1945. I think Hess was a minister without portfolio for a while as well. Mm-hmm. So he must have replaced him. Do you know about Wilhelm Frick at all, Dennis?
I think it's... I did a video, one of the first videos what I ever had banned, where I paid tribute to the Germans who got hung after Nuremberg. And he had one of them, I think he had one of them scars down his face, which a lot of them had from the upper class, from the fencing. You know, they never used to wear proper helmets. What was he called, the other one? Can't think of his name now. Well, quite a few of the Germans and the Austrians had this scar down the face, and I'm pretty sure he was one of them.
Yeah, I remember that. I know the scar that you're talking about, the noble art of fencing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Wilhelm Frick, he said, every race has the right to protect itself, just as the Jewish race has done for thousands of years. You will have the same problem in America. The whites don't want to intermarry with Negroes. The Nuremberg laws were for the protection of the Aryan race. Hanging, I didn't expect anything different. So again, he's pointing out the truth there, that it's completely unnatural to expect races to interbreed together. And the whites didn't want to intermarry with Negroes. So, I mean, how they can be complaining about that? At the time in America, they still had laws to prevent that, I think, didn't they? 1945.
Well, the problem is, like I said, they don't really understand what the Allies have in store. Because, as you know, for instance, every Christmas, without a doubt, you'll see a couple in an advertisement and one will be coloured and one will be white. Usually it's the woman that's white. And it's just this constant brainwashing. And then you've got this, fear of being racist and all the time. That's being drummed in. And it gets to a point where each generation is watered down more and more. And so they begin to believe that it's a natural thing to do. You know, if you go back several generations, back towards the 50s, it was probably abhorrent to go with a coloured guy. But these days, you know, they're making it so the people who are against it are the ones who are wrong.
Well, it's the hypocrisy of it, isn't it? I mean, they were complaining that they had made these laws to prevent Jews from intermarrying Germans, and there were laws in America to prevent white people from intermarrying with Negroes. And that's a perfectly good argument to make. And you could also make the argument that, well, these were just the laws of the Catholic Church, the laws that have been in place since the 4th century, I think, when they first brought out a law to prevent Jews from marrying Christians. Mm-hmm. And it was the same law. I think there's one of the National Socialist movies that makes reference to that, that, how long it's been. I think the Germans have always had a law saying that the Jews shouldn't marry the German Christians. And it had just been ignored since about 1850, but up until that point, there had always been this law, and all the National Socialists did was bring this law out again. They didn't really need to make a new one. All they had to do was say, well, we're just going to carry out the law. And you could do that today.
I'm surprised the Pope has never mentioned anything about this. He's mentioned about everything else, but I don't ever remember him mentioning, this is Pope Francis I'm talking about, I don't ever remember him mentioning race mixing.
Well, this is it, isn't it? The Pope can't undo anything that a previous Pope has said. They just sort of ignore it and pretend that it doesn't count anymore.
Look at Freemasonry. I mean, once over, the Catholic Church said any Catholic becomes a Freemason, he's kicked out of the Church, and only, you know, possibly on a dying deathbed can he be, you know, saved. Other than that, you know, you're out. And now, there's no problem with Freemasonry in the Catholic Church. So things have all been turned upside down because of the infiltration. But I'm saying I'm surprised they haven't heard Francis say more about this subject.
Well, maybe it's an angle that people could take instead of saying, "Well, we want to be separated from these people. We want to make it illegal to have miscegenation." We could say, "Well, we just want the original laws to be upheld. The laws that say that Jews can't marry Christians, and Jews have to live apart from Christians, and Jews aren't allowed to interfere in civil society." And this is what E. Michael Jones says, that sicit Judaeus non. He says that, the Catholic Church developed this way to deal with the Jews and the effect that they had on the Gentiles that they lived among. And what they wanted to do was protect the Jews from any harm. And at the same time, they wanted to protect the Gentiles from any harm from the Jews through being demoralized and encouraged to indulge in vice, basically. So in order to prevent that, they said, well, the Jews have to wear some item of clothing to show that they are a Jew, so that the Gentile is aware that it's a Jew that he's dealing with, so he needs to be extra careful, and they need to be kept separate, they need to live separately, so that their bad ways don't, or their different ways, you could say, because, I mean, to the Jew, the way he behaves, it isn't bad, it's just natural to him, so that their different ways don't get copied by the white people living alongside them. And obviously there shouldn't be any intermarriage. And the rabbis themselves don't say that they don't want any intermarriage between Jews and white people, because they say that that will dilute the Jewish race. So we could just say, well, exactly. Look, we just want to go back to the old laws. And it wouldn't be that hard.
It's the same immigration. I mean, Israel doesn't take any immigrants, but all the rest of the world has to. They're ruling to themselves, and that goes along with everything else.
Maybe things might have turned out a bit different if Hitler had said that. Instead of, we've got these Nuremberg laws, these new race laws, if he'd said, well, we're going to institute the Catholic laws, we're going to start following the Catholic laws and enforcing them instead of ignoring them, maybe they wouldn't have been able to do this to him and say, oh, you brought in these Nuremberg laws that were so unjust and cruel.
I think they've changed so much of history anyway. You can't even be sure. He did say it. He may have. But there's been lots in Germany been hidden away, as I found out firsthand.
Well, that's a good point there, Dennis. They at the end of the war, they destroyed everything that they could that was National Socialist. And when you find books today, a lot of the time they're reprinted stuff that's been rewritten by Americans. They're not, original English translations or something.
Well, I can recommend anybody listening, if you go to YouTube and search The War of Many Fathers, it's an actual conference of the author who wrote the book. And there's an English version as well, but there's also a German version with subtitles. And he goes into great detail of how at the end of the war, things were changed. They even made Hitler's speeches to sound more aggressive and more warlike.
All the educational books as well.
Textbooks were changed. 5 years all this took.
Yeah, if you think about it, how long were they in power for? About 10 years, and they changed the whole education system. They had all textbooks that were racially based. Where are the copies of them? They just don't exist. And you think
they burnt them, didn't they?
Yeah, think how much that was. Think how many books and how many documents and information that was that they got rid of in order to be able to do that.
Oh, it's tremendous. Phenomenal. I mean, some people used to argue with me saying all this denial of Holocaust and everything else. It would mean everybody moving in unison and everybody sticking together, which is exactly what happened. They just can't see how it's all been organised.
And then the brainwashing that took place afterwards to turn the children against their parents and against their grandfathers, and until you end up today with Germans ashamed of being German and thinking that the British did the right thing to destroy half their country. Now, when you think about, how often we hear about the Blitz here in Britain, there was nothing compared to what happened to Germany. And this lie that, we had to bring all these Negroes over to help rebuild the country after the war. The country wasn't damaged. There was hardly any damage done. to Britain, when you compare it to the damage that was done to Germany, to cities.
It was ironic, actually, that they used a German battleship to bring them over with. Just after, you know, 19... Windrush.
Yeah. Originally, 50s. It was the SS something. It was one of the Strength Through Joy vessels.
Mm.
It was for the workers, one of the vessels that took them on cruises originally.
Right. Yeah. Well, I knew it was German. Just, I suppose, a way of having a laugh. Eh?
Yeah, but when you hear the Negroes today and they say, well, you brought us over to help rebuild your country after the war. We were desperately needed and we're responsible for building Britain. You know, there was 100 times more damage was done to Germany. And
women had to rebuild Germany.
Yeah, and other places in Europe, did they all have an invasion at that time of Negroes from Jamaica claiming that they were rebuilding the country? I don't think they did.
No, they will eventually, no doubt, but I don't think they rushed them over.
But, you know, just how much it implies that there was loads and loads of building work that needed to be done and Britain was in a terrible state and it really wasn't. There's only a few places that were hit.
By the time we got to the 60s, the excuse was they would do jobs that English people wouldn't do. That was another one.
Yeah, basically toilet attendants, bus drivers. And of course, now you look at it and you see them being weathermen or weatherwomen and TV presenters and doing all the stuff on BBC. And you think, isn't there any white people that want to do that? Are they still doing the jobs that white people don't want to do?
They're still cleaning the toilets, the white people, if they've got a job.
Yeah, if they got a job. I must admit, you know, that was where you used to see them, really, in London, was just driving the buses or cleaning the toilets.
Yeah, yeah.
Not
railway. Yeah.
Doing something absolutely essential, rebuilding the country.
No, because they're not, I mean, that were the Irish, if anybody. Because the Irish are the builders, you know.
Well, they built the roads, didn't they, I think, in the last century.
Yeah, the motorways and you went to any... building site. They were always Irish in charge.
I do think that sometimes when I'm driving along the country lanes, you think, you know, at some point in the last century, there was a load of Irish here that were putting this road down, and it's still there today. It's you know, it's still all solid and, you know, little one-track tarmac lane, and you think, you know, how many of these lanes are there that are crisscrossing over Britain, and you can imagine this team of Irish navvies just going all around the country laying these roads. You know, that was essential. That was essential, and they don't call them the Irish navvy generation. We haven't got statues to them and all this nonsense that we have with this Windrush generation.
Well, they went through a stage where Irish were turned away from digs as well because they were looked on as white, you know, niggers, as they say.
You know, I can't think, or they can't actually point to one thing that this Windrush generation actually built in Britain. Otherwise, they would be. You know, if they supposedly came here to help rebuild the country, why can't they actually point to any of the things that they built? Where is this wonderful... examples of Negro engineering rebuilding cathedrals or rebuilding the city centre that was hit during the Blitz? Where is this fantastic Negro expertise? There isn't any, is there?
It's just I can't envision many on a building site. I've never, you know, I've been past a few building sites in my time and I've never actually seen any. You know, they've always been, as I said, either English or Irish.
Well, they're not known for building, are they?
You know, it's a fact. Transport, yeah, you know, they'll drive a bus and drive a train.
And you know, if you set aside the fact that they lived in dung huts in Africa, the Windrush generation came from Jamaica. And what's Jamaica got? Shanty towns. Shanty towns with corrugated roofs. You know, and there's none of that in Britain, thankfully. But that's what they've got expertise in building. It's a whole pack of lies that, you know, that we needed the Windrush generation to rebuild Britain. But when people say that, you should ask them to point out, you know, an example of anything that was actually built by them that we could see.
It's a fair point.
Proof of that.
I'm going to be honest.
Next one that we've got here is Hans Frank, and he was the Governor General of the occupied Polish territories. He was also executed. Do you know anything about Hans Frank, Dennis?
Yeah, he was put in charge, a Roman Catholic. He was put in charge after Poland fell, and he put the Jews in the ghettos for obvious reasons. So obviously he was a target at the end of the war.
Now, what would have been the reason for that? Because the Jews were enemy agents. They were
well,
you know, they were
a number of reasons, really. One, for their own safety. Two, like you say, you know, you keep them all together because then they're not an influence on Christians, and Poland is a Catholic country. No difference again to what the Vatican did years before. And, you know, but obviously that's been used as propaganda as well, saying that they kept them in ghettos. And I mean, it weren't like they were kept in ghettos and did no food, you know what I mean? Like, but, you know, all these things are twisted.
Well, one way that people could understand it is if you just say, well, all the British that were in Germany, or all the British that were in Poland when Germany went into Poland, they put them in a separate area. Of course, that makes sense because Britain's at war with Poland. So, of course, you're going to put any people that are actually a member of the foreign nation that's at war with you, you're going to put them somewhere separate and you're going to keep them contained. You're going to watch them very closely. And that's exactly what they did with the Jews. And people don't realise that the Jews were part of the Allies that were fighting against Germany. They were part of these enemy countries that had declared war upon Germany. In fact, they were the first ones with declaring war with their economic boycott. So they were seen as enemy agents. They were a threat. They were, you know, they were prone to being terrorists, partisans. This French resistance, I was listening to a Karin Jaeger show the other day, a very, very good one about the Gestapo, with Margaret Hufstickler, I think, presented it. And she said that this French resistance, up until Operation Barbarossa, there really wasn't any French resistance. And then they suddenly got all this trouble over there with these people calling themselves French resistance. And they were all Russian Jews. Well, 90% of them were Jews from elsewhere. They weren't actually even from France. And yet they were calling themselves the French resistance. So it was Jews that made up a large portion of these terrorist gangs that were going around the countries that were occupied by Germany. Germany was trying to have a peaceful occupation, trying not to upset the people that they were occupying. And it was expected that at the end of the war, they would go home. The Germans would go home. It was just, we are just here to prevent the Allies using your country as a springboard to get to us. That's the only reason why we are here, as for defensive purposes. So why would they, you know, oppress the people that they were occupying? They weren't. They tried to make things as easy as possible for them. And then these terrorists would come in, these Jewish terrorists would come in and blow up railway lines, shoot Germans in the back, and they wouldn't have any uniform on. And then they would expect to be treated by the Geneva Convention if they were caught.
That's right.
I was going to say,
Poland, of course, was screwed over at the end of the war more than anybody. They'd been used to start the war in the first place. And then Stalin was waiting. The Poles heard a radio broadcast saying that the Russians are going to move in to help them. So they created an uprising against the Germans. Stalin didn't move. And again, you've got to take this in a context that it was the US bankers who controlled Stalin. So, you know, they're quite happy to see Germany put down this uprising, probably killed a lot of Christians doing it. And then, you know, Stalin later came in, and as it showed in the documentary, they actually dressed up as Polish soldiers and eventually took the Polish leadership back to the Soviet Union, and where they imprisoned them, put them on trial and executed them.
So that
got screwed over really badly.
So that Warsaw Uprising, that was, you know, that was terrorist Jews trying to start an uprising.
That was on the strength that they were told that Stalin was going to move in with his troops to back him up, and he never did. His army never moved.
So once again, we're told, well, the nasty Germans just picked on these Jews in their ghetto, when the truth of it is that they were a terrorist army, an army of enemies that were trying to get rid of the Germans. who were trying to peacefully occupy the place. Well, Hans Frank was he was the general of the occupied Polish territories. As you said, he was a Catholic, Dennis. And he said, did God ordain all this? Did God nod his head as Jews were led into the gas chambers? So he's quite clearly been told about this gas chamber myth. And I would say he's mocking it there. And saying, did God just allow that to happen?
Some, see the execution, I think they hung him on the grounds of Auschwitz in a black hood, if you remember the scene at all.
I should have put the exact charges down. I did put the exact charges down for some of them, but it's just that they were all executed and they were accused of crimes against peace, war crimes. And I guess so his crime, he would have been defending himself against Jewish terrorists in the Warsaw Uprising.
No doubt. Oh, I'm thinking of somebody else. I'm thinking of I'm thinking of the last person who was hung at Auschwitz.
Would that have been the commander of Auschwitz, the guy that was in charge?
Yes, that's the one, yeah.
Commander Hirst. That was the second one that we did.
Yeah, it was hung on the ground, yeah.
Yeah, this is Hans Frank here. We've got another quote from him. He said, "You can't go against a law of nature. The Austrian and German people simply could not be kept apart. It was like trying to keep apart an irresistible force in nature. I'd just like to see them examine the Anschluss of Azerbaijan by the Russians with the same kind of arguments and documents." So that's a good one, comparing the merging of Austria and Germany with the merging of Russia and Azerbaijan, which obviously was not complained about. But this was. They were furious about the Anschluss, weren't they? Absolutely furious.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were, yeah. I mean, the thing is, if you notice that all these people replacing the leaders previous, they're all Christian. This is a Christian movement.
And also this merging of Austria and Germany, they were the same people, and yet it's put across today that it was an annexation. It was an annexation of Austria, and the Austrian people didn't want it. They did want it. They had a plebiscite and said that they wanted it, and Hitler was welcomed into Austria with a hero's welcome. This Austrian boy who had done so well, it was a fantastic day. You got the footage of it in your documentary, Dennis.
Yeah. The War of the Flowers, they called it.
Never see so many people. Mm-hmm. All in one place, and you can really feel the emotion of them. Incredible emotional time, and that's turned around. And that was Hitler invading Austria.
Well, don't forget as well, when Hitler left Austria, he was like an artist looking for work, obviously. And when he's come back, he's more or less out of Europe. So this is a son returning, the highest possible, from the highest possible mountain.
Yeah, who's put Austria on the world stage. This is a son of Austria that has succeeded in doing this. And also you got the increase in living standards for Austria once they had joined up with Germany and were part of the National Socialist system.
Got rid of usury, took the fortunes off the Rothschilds, put the Rothschild up for ransom, because he felt that he'd robbed the Austrians of money. So he was trying to, put things right without actually causing a war.
And you also got the crown jewels and the exhibition of the crown jewels of the Second Reich.
The Holy Reich. That's right, the Holy Roman Empire, Third Reich,
as we talked about, and the exhibition of one of those holy relics, and millions of people came to see this relic, this cloak, wasn't it? Cloak of Jesus. That hadn't been seen for years.
That's never mentioned.
At that time, they obviously had the blessing of the Catholic Church when this happened.
Without a doubt, because I was looking through one of the episodes today when we were talking about this Intermarium, and one of the speakers from the Vatican was saying that the Pope before Pius, the one who signed the Concordat, the Pope at that time was adamantly against communism, and so was all for Germany for signing this Concordat. So, you know, there's evidence again of this. Well, we know the story, don't we? Where they managed to get Hitler into power, told the Catholic party to vote for him, and then disbanded it. And this has never been revealed. You know, it's always been kept under wraps.
I think in Austria, the people that were in power in Austria, they were keen for this to happen with Germany as well. I think the chap that was actually in power in Austria before it happened, I think they went after him in the Nuremberg trials as well. Mm. Was it part of the Versailles Treaty that Austria and Germany could not
merge? Never join.
Had they been joined before at any point?
Yeah, it was a historical thing, which has always been there. You know, I mean, sometimes it had been joined, other times they'd been split, but it were always a historical moment that Austrians and Germans always wanted to be rejoined because they are the same.
It was the Osterreich, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was called. And because Austria before had a ruling thing with Hungary, didn't they? Austrian-Hungarian Empire for a while?
Yeah, that's right. And don't forget, when Hitler went to join the army in World War One, he didn't go to fight for Austria. He went to fight for Germany. He joined a German regiment.
So this was an accepted thing, that the Germans and the Austrians were brothers. I mean, I would say it's probably similar to, say, Wales and England.
I would say, yeah. I mean, probably even not that, because, you know, there's a distinct language difference with the Welsh and the English. So not even that, really. Closer than that.
Maybe North and South England.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, more like it.
Or Londoners and the rest of England. So even closer than England and Wales, and yet this was some heinous crime that had taken place, that these two kindred peoples decided to merge together and partake of the benefits.
Yeah, I think it all comes from their scourge of Germany being a major power.
Yeah, that was what it was all about. Preventing Germany occupying the same place on the world stage as Britain and America and France. Yeah. And France.
Well, and France. It's always M3 involved in what goes on today, like in Libya and, you know, other places, France, England, all the Masonic countries.
Yeah, we forget how important France is, really. You've got quite a lot of the world that speaks French. Got half of Canada.
Yeah, they got some colonies, didn't they?
Yeah, a lot of these African countries speak French, the same as we've got African countries that speak English.
Someone else I learned as well, because the French fought down in Vietnam once over, then the Americans took over, if you remember. And then Harold Wilson said that Britain will not be sending soldiers, but they did.
At the time, Germany was the only country that didn't actually have any colonies. Everyone else did.
Well, they had them took off after World War One.
Right. Because that's what Hitler was saying. Everybody else has got colonies because they know that their nations are going to expand. They're going to need new land. We don't have any. But there is lots of unused land in Russia that we could develop and then share the proceeds of that with the Russians, the proceeds of the advances in civilization that they would have. And that was this, you know, the whole idea that he had. It wasn't about invading and taking over the world. It was just equity, really, with the other countries of Europe that had all expanded. Well, the next one I've got here is Hans Fritsch. And he's a bit of a different one. He wasn't executed. He was the Reich Minister of Public Enlightenment and Propaganda. So I guess that's the equivalent of being in charge of the BBC. He was present in the Berlin Führerbunker during the last days of Adolf Hitler. After Hitler's death, he went over to the Soviet lines in Berlin to offer the surrender of the city to the Red Army on the 1st of May 1945. He was taken prisoner. Fritsch was taken prisoner by the Soviet Red Army soldiers. At first, he was held prisoner in a basement, and then he was sent to Moscow for interrogation at Lubyanka prison, where, according to his own account, 3 gold teeth were yanked from his mouth upon arrival. He was confined to a standing coffin, a 3-foot square cell, where it was impossible to sleep, and placed on a bread and hot water diet. He eventually signed a confession. Later, while on trial at Nuremberg, he wrote his account of Soviet prison, which was published in Scotland. Fritsch was sent to Nuremberg and tried before the International Military Tribunal. He was charged with conspiracy to commit crimes against peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. In his positions in the propaganda apparatus of the National Socialist State, Fritsch played a role to further the so-called conspiracy to commit atrocities and to launch the war of aggression. According to journalist and author William L. Shirer, it was unclear to the attendees why he was actually charged. Shirer remarked that no one in the courtroom, including Fritsch, seemed to know why he was there. He was too small a fry, unless it were as a ghost for Goebbels. Alexander Hardy, an associate counsel for the prosecution at the Nuremberg trials, argued that Fritsch was much more important than he actually appeared. After being acquitted, Fritsch worked with the prosecution. Here, Hardy notes that Fritsch showed remarkable knowledge of the press directives from the National Socialist government, including knowledge of the planned invasion of Poland 4 months before it occurred, and worked closely with Otto Dietrich. According to Hardy, this was evidence that he was actually guilty of the crimes he was accused of. He was one of only three defendants to be acquitted at Nuremberg, along with Hjalmar Schacht and Franz von Papen. He was later tried by a West German denazification court and was sentenced to 9 years. He was released in September 1950 and died of cancer 3 years later, and his wife died the same year. So I just thought that was quite an interesting story, because it shows you that the communists were torturing them for a start in order to get confessions. And I don't know whether that confession was used at Nuremberg or not, but the communists were doing that, and so were the British, so were the Americans. That was how the Allies got their confessions. And then he turns on the National Socialists, and I don't know that there was anybody else that actually turned on them. And then he actually helped the prosecution to go after them. And I think that's why he was allowed to live. And also, that confirms the quote from Goering that we had in the first episode, Dennis, where he said about the small fry. And
I remember that.
Yeah, why are these people here? I don't even know who they are. And it was just because this was a show trial, and they wanted to get people, basically. And I think he's right here saying that it's because they really wanted Goebbels and they couldn't get him, so they put this guy on trial.
Yeah, yeah.
And also maybe because they wanted to say, well, you see, it wasn't all a done deal. We did acquit some of them. We aren't really the bad guys, you know.
Well, that must come into play, I suppose. Like I said about any books written after 1945, even books like from Albert Speer cannot be trusted, because He can't write what he wants to write. Otherwise, he goes straight back to prison.
Yeah, I see. That's a good point. They all have to go along with the Nuremberg results, basically. Only they because they would be accused of Holocaust denial if they didn't, for a start, and they could be accused of perjury, because that was, you know, it was found in a court of law that all of this happened. So if they to then go back on it now, they were the ones that would be in trouble, regardless of the fact that all these confessions were obtained under torture and were against the law anyway.
Different today in Germany, because in the Holocaust trial, Alfred Schaefer, is it? He was charged again after he gave evidence in a court, in a public court, repeating why he said certain things, which meant he was committing a crime again, and was obviously charged again for these statements in this public court. And now they've added something like another 4 years.
For trying to defend himself, for trying to defend his statements.
Yeah, and for talking about, you know, trying to clear himself, but talking about this subject in front of a public gallery. Can you believe that one?
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. It just gets worse and worse. Once you build something on a lie, it just gets worse and worse. It just gets more and more lies that get involved in it, and more effects of it that you weren't aware of. I was talking about this earlier with Grandpa Lampshade in the Daily Nationalist about this homosexual lie. And then from that, you get the transsexual lie. And now you've got people that are claiming to be homosexual, but that has a transsexual boyfriend. So in actual fact, they're no longer homosexual, but they're actually sort of male and female by today's standards. But of course they're not, they're still homosexual. And it's all this confusion, and it all comes from telling these lies in the start. Well, we've got his quote here, and he said, "On the contrary, my friends, this means the beginning of the Hitler legend." And how correct was he?
Yeah, it's a good call.
And it wasn't just the Nuremberg trials, though. I mean, they helped to cement it, I guess, the unjustness of that. But just, you know, taking on the rest of the world anyway, I think the Hitler legend had already begun before then, but it certainly did add to it. Having these Nuremberg trials, and also you got this infamy as well. You know, the infamous Adolf Hitler that killed 6 million Jews. That was really the what the Nuremberg trials cemented, wasn't it?
Yeah.
This evil persona of Hitler.
That's right. Most evil man ever.
Yeah, and he
was seen as Ted Bundy didn't come into the reckoning.
Yeah, he was seen as the Messiah of Germany before then. He was the liberator of Germany, and they had to turn that around. All right, Dennis, we've reached the end of the podcast today. Thank you very much for coming on. We'll be back next week with part 3 of quotes from the Nuremberg trials. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I hope you all have a great weekend ahead of you.